better put him in the Heisman.
Got that award right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light Seltzer for those anytime easy drinking occasions.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team that's on the way back. A College World Series title. The Bomb Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast.
We talked about the other day how Arkansas, according to Pro Football Focus, has the toughest schedule in college football. Now, Pro Football Focus is not the only one that's voiced that opinion. There's a few other outlets that either have Arkansas at the top of the list, top three, top five of the most toughest schedules in college football. The season already looked bleak. At this point, you're already thinking, oh, it's not going to be a great season. This team's not going to a bowl game. But then you pile on that. Then you pile on the coronavirus, which has prevented Arkansas and so many other schools get ready through spring ball and other activities. And you think to yourself, man, this is just really hurting Arkansas right now. It doesn't seem to be any positives. But you know what? As an Arkansan, as an Arkansas fan, you wish sometimes that life would come easier. You wish sometimes that you'd have a quicker path to prestige or a quicker path to what you want in life. But that's not always the case, and that's fine. You're looked down upon as an Arkansan. You're looked at as not as smart or not as intelligent or a variety of different things that people like to pin on you just because they say, oh, you're from Arkansas. And now Arkansas football is facing this monumental blockade of, hey, you're not going to be able to do anything this season. You're not going to be able to do this. You're not going to be able to do that. And all that should do is just motivate you even more. Obstacles should not deter you from getting to where you want to be. They should motivate you even more, especially when it comes to college football and winning college football games. So it's a little frustrating, Tommy, that not only is Arkansas having to deal with the coronavirus, but the toughest schedule in college football.
Well, I mean, it's going to be one of the tougher schedules every year just based on who's on your SEC West schedule every year. So not a surprise that it's a difficult schedule. You add Notre Dame into it, it takes a notch or two up from that. It seems like Bielema had a year where his was the toughest. This isn't new. This isn't unprecedented. Arkansas is always going to have one of the tougher schedules, and some of the tougher schedules in college football belong in the SEC West. It's just another aspect or a tribute, if you will, to how difficult this league is.
And when you add a non-conference opponent, especially on the road, that's the caliber of the Notre Dame Fighting Irish in a year that they're going to be top 10 preseason. And I don't know if they can contend for a college football playoff, but Ian Book and that squad is definitely going to have an impact on who makes the college football playoff. This is a tough year for Arkansas football. You factor in new coordinators, new head coach, the coronavirus. There's a lot of things going against Arkansas right now. But you need this endless work ethic. You need this endless mentality, the never give up mantra that you've seen over the years with Arkansas. Because as I mentioned earlier, as an Arkansan, for a variety of reasons, you're looked down upon. For whatever reason, people like to thumb their nose at you when just looking at you being from the natural state. To me, is very frustrating and should aggravate you just as much as it aggravates me. It's one thing if you do something or act a certain way and that enacts someone to think that way about you. But when the perception is you're already a lower tier human being just because you're from a certain state, that should rile you up a little bit. And as an Arkansan, a lot of times when you get into group settings, group situations and stuff, especially up in the Northeast or out West, people just, hey, they don't have a lot of good things to say about you, which to me, like, I've always learned Southern hospitality as a young boy, so I try and treat people the same regardless of skin color, regardless of religious beliefs, regardless of whatever. I don't dislike someone particularly just because they're from a certain pocket of the United States or think down of someone because of a certain pocket, and that ties into football a little bit, especially when the team has sucked these last couple years. When you've gone 2-10 the past two seasons, 4-8 the year before, haven't had a really successful college football season since 2011, you think, oh, those factors don't tie in together. I guarantee you they do. They they tie in together, whether it's this really tight knot or if it's loose tied, they do tie in together. So hopefully you have this. Who said the buck stops here? Who's the president that said that?
I don't know. I don't know who to attribute that
Jenkins,
to.
We looked that up real quick.
That's obviously a phrase we've all heard.
I can't remember the president that said that. But again, you have to put your foot in the ground. You have to put your foot in the sand as the head coach of the University of Arkansas and Sam Pittman, as one of the players, and say, we're done with this.
That'd be President Harry S. Truman.
That was going to be my guess, was Truman, because I remember that's exactly right. The buck stops here. So is the buck going to stop with Sam Pittman? Is this the line in the sand we're going to draw and get this program back in the right direction? If so, you're going to do it against some of the toughest teams in college football and some tough road trips this year.
It's like a line of demarcation. It's like we're not going below this point anymore. We don't want to feel like this. And I know fans sometimes say, oh, you don't experience the pain we're feeling. I guarantee you the coaches and the players in that locker room these past 2 years, and hopefully the ones this year, if they suffer losses, will feel more pain than you do as a fan. I know that's hard to believe sometimes, but the players take it harder than anyone else outside of maybe the coaching staff. Maybe a head coach might take it a little harder, but that's definitely one of those things where it hurts for everyone. But I guarantee you the players are feeling it just as much. And they don't want to get back to that point. They grew up watching Arkansas football having success. They grew up watching teams that Arkansas had that were less thought of and winning football games. And that was the whole thought behind Arkansas football. It's like, okay, you're going to think this of us? Okay, then we're going to do this on the field. You have to prove once again that Arkansas actually belongs in the SEC. Now, I'm not talking about the upper echelon of LSU, Alabama, and Georgia. You don't have to get back to that point yet. I'm just talking about getting on that field and doing something to make you not look like the fool. You have to allow the fans to prove to opposing coaches and opposing players that this fan base can be intimidating again. There should be a scared factor when someone walks into Donald W. Reynolds Razorback Stadium, because that was the case in 2006, 98, 2010, 2011. I'm not talking about it was the height of maybe LSU in Death Valley or Bryant Denny, the Horseshoe, and some of the other venues like that, but there was an uneasy feeling as an opposing quarterback when you walked into Donald W. back in the day. And now it's all butterflies. It's, oh, okay, we're playing Arkansas. This should be an easy day. That needs to stop this year. End it.
So what's it take to make that end?
Winning games.
Well, how many games? How many games are going to take? Because A, what you're talking about, yes, needs to happen. B, not going to happen this year. You're going to have to win 5 or 6 this year, I think, to get fans energized enough to come back to 85-90% capacity in the stadium.
I think 5's the magic number. 4 should be the expectations. 3 non-cons, 1 conference win. 5 gets people out of their seat. 6 wins, people lose their freaking minds. You got to give life back to the state. The coronavirus, the racial tension. I mean, so much of this crap going on right now. Give life back to the state. Football means so much to the state. Give life back to it.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a premium light lager brewed with real lemonade.
He does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number 3, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
Want to get in this article written by Buck Ringhold coming up on the southwesttimes.com at the Times Record, talking about Isaiah Joe. He got some insight, some really good insight from both Isaiah's head basketball coach in high school, Coach Eric Burnett, and then also his dad, Derek. So I was reading this article last night. This has been really the most polarizing basketball topic for quite some time. It was first, hey, what's Mason going to do? What's his decision? He made his. He's going to the next level. He's trying to make it in the NBA. And that now begs the question, hey, what's Isaiah going to do? What's his timeline? What's he going to do? We know that August the 17th is the last day to early withdrawal from the NBA draft. So if you do not withdraw after that point or before that point, you will stay in the NBA and then you cannot come back to college. So he's still got, Tommy, about 2 months, because we got July and then August, and I know we're a little past that point, so a little less than 2 months before he can make his decision. Now, you think he's probably going to make it into July? That's what you said last week?
I'm just trying to apply what I think is common sense logic in the fact that if classes at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville begin on schedule, which are generally in mid-July, I don't know what the first class date is, but I'm going to guess it's somewhere August 15th-ish, somewhere in that neighborhood. Is that about right?
To pick classes or whatever?
No, when classes begin for the fall semester.
Look that up.
There's going to be a deadline. What I'm saying, there's a deadline to be a student and a student athlete at the University of Arkansas. You've got to make sure everything's there. And I don't know that how much time he's spending Fort Smith versus Fayetteville right now.
Classes begin on the 24th, Tommy.
Okay, 24th. So that gives you a little more idea. So these players are going to be up there practicing. I think all indications are he'll be a part of some of that. I'm just saying there's logistics about being in place to start the fall semester. So I would suspect that they'll make a decision somewhere end of July, early August. Whether they make that public or not, I don't know. But if you're going to come back to school, there's certain things you got to have in place logistically just to pull that off.
We heard from Eric Musselman about a month or so ago talking with the Arkansas media that he was adamant in the fact that Isaiah and his family had decided not to hire an agent. Because when you hire an agent, specifically a certain agent, you are no longer eligible to come back to college. That's not going to happen. They're going to play out this process. And in Buck's article, he talks with Coach Eric Burnett, head coach of Fort Smith Northside, and he asked him what his thoughts on Isaiah maybe going off to the NBA, coming back to college. And Coach Burnett is under the impression that he's saying it's 50-50. This is a guy that knows Isaiah, coached Isaiah. So, when it comes to, we haven't heard Jack really when it comes to people inside, quote unquote, Isaiah's circle. So it's nice to get some information from a guy that's apparently inside Isaiah's circle just on his debate and what he's doing. 50-50, I think initially I was probably 70-30 Isaiah going to the draft compared to coming back to college. But again, the longer this plays out, I think that it's more likely that he comes back to school. Yeah. Regardless of the decision he makes, you should be ecstatic for him as a Razorback fan. If he goes off to the NBA, he decides, listen, I'm going to take my talents to the professional. I should see as many congratulations on social media, as many call-ins to this radio show, excited about his future. Now, we know, as radio hosts, the excitement level is going to dwarf that if he comes back to school, right, which is only natural as an Arkansas fan. Yes, you want the guys that come through the program, regardless of which one, to have success at the professional level. But you know as well as I do, you're a Razorback fan first most of the time, and then professional level second, or fan of former Razorbacks at the professional level second. So if he were to come back, you'd even see more of an excitement, more of a congratulations. And I'm just curious to see what ends up happening. This is going to be an interesting next few weeks and month or so to see what he decides to do with his future.
And only him and those in his circle probably know what the threshold is. If your information coming back from the NBA doesn't project you over what spot, is it into first round, early second round? At what point do you say, no, it's not worth coming out early? I don't know what that line of demarcation, if you will, is for Isaiah, his family, those around him to say, the smart decisions to go back or the smart decisions to stay. Is it financial? Because you can kind of get an idea based on your slot what you're going to get financially from these teams. I would be just a little more skeptical this year just based on the idea that playing international, we're seeing minor league baseball has been eliminated. Our G League and all of these developmental leagues for the NBA going to go on as planned? There's just so much uncertainty. We know these leagues are going to focus on what? Where the money's at. And that's going to be the NBA, Major League Baseball, the NFL. All this developmental stuff is going to go by the wayside a little bit in the short term. So, and then the other thing you got to ask, what will another year of playing for Eric Musselman do for my draft status? And you can't believe it's going to – I don't think there's any scenario where another healthy year at least can hurt that. So I'll be surprised. You're a little more leaning, and I think you're coming back to the middle on this. You've been leaning that he's going to go. I think I'm going to lean a little more he's going to stay.
Well, here's my thoughts, and I've said this, and Clay and I have had differing opinions on this. Who would have thought that Clay and I would disagree about something? But my whole thing with Mason is Clay thought, well, he said that, well, Mason's going to have more players around him. Maybe his job will be easier. My whole mindset has been with both Mason and Isaiah, yes, there's more talent around him. Yes, they're not going to get double-teamed, but the touches aren't going to be directed at those two guys. Isaiah, while he may be the focal point of that offense next year, I'm curious to see how much more spread out it is. Which, and I think with Mason and Isaiah, if you're separating the two guys, that helps Isaiah more than it helps Mason, because Mason, as we saw last year, is better with the ball in his hands, more of a ball hawk savvy when he has more touches. I think Isaiah can excel when there's more pieces around him and stuff. I'm just wondering if he's going to get the same amount of touches. I think he averaged 16.7 points this past season, and that was with injuries hampering some of what he could do this past year. I'm curious if we see a giant role, if the role goes up, if he has more on-ball situations that Eric Musselman calls for him, if we see him get more shots up, if he can keep his field goal percentage and his three-point percentage even at like either at the same clip or a higher clip, because he's going to be attempting more shots. Those are the things I'm wondering about Isaiah, and those are the things that he's having conversations with his former coach, Eric Burnett. He's having conversation with his dad and his family. He's having conversations probably with Coach Musk. He's probably got a lot of different factors that he has to figure out in what's best for his career to come back or to go. But I'm definitely, like you said, I'm leaning more the longer this goes on.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the way I look at it is, you know, when a really good football team plays a really bad one, and the longer that team's, the crappy team's in the game, the more likely there is a chance for them to win. Arkansas isn't, not that Arkansas is in the crappy situation, but the NBA is more appealing than coming back to school. So the longer this plays out, I think Arkansas has a better chance of keeping Isaiah for one more year. But then again, he could wait till the last minute and decide, I think I need to go to the NBA. And again, as an Arkansas fan, you should applaud him regardless.
Yeah, I mean, you still got agents to consider. You've still got a lot of things professionally that you need to investigate. And I'm sure that's what his family and those around him are doing. A lot of things that you have to think about before you make that final decision. Again, why rush to the decision if the deadline is, you know, month and a half off from now? But, you know, one of the biggest decisions he'll ever make in his life, and there's no going back. Once you enter that, there's you know, you're past the point of return. So I think his ceiling is higher than that. Mason had no more ceiling if he came back. How much better a year? How much more improvement could Mason Jones have made? Minimal. To me, Isaiah Joe, you know, particularly coming off a year with an injury and just watching him as a player, where he's at in his development, everyone you talk to talks about his higher ceiling. What could one more year, what would his draft slot look like with one more year of improvement?
Because you and I both agreed on with Mason and Isaiah that Mason had more to lose if he came back. Not to say he didn't have anything to gain if he came back, but we felt like as a whole, and I think the majority of you listening right now would agree, that Mason would have less to gain if he came back to the U of A. But like you, I think Isaiah could gain more by coming back. And I think it amounts to, like you're saying, could be a potential first-round draft pick if things fall the right way. If he doesn't have an or if he has an injury-free season, if we think he can take even the next step in this year. I'll say this time and time again. Isaiah has yet to be the guy in college. Daniel was it this first year, Daniel Gafford, and Mason was it last year. Does that appeal to Isaiah at all? He comes across as a really mild-mannered, quiet, humble kid. Does that idea, and it's not just for the ego, Tommy, but it's to show NBA teams, hey, I can be a really good shooter, I can be a really good defender, I can be a really good role player. Oh, and by the way, I can actually, if you need me to, I can be the number one guy. Not to say that he's going to be the number one guy on whatever team he's drafted to, but it's just to show versatility to GMs, to scouts, to different front office people in the National Basketball Association and say, hey, I can take on so many different roles. I'm not a hindrance in the locker room. I can do what so many NBA teams are trending towards, which is shoot the laces off the ball. Isaiah is capable of doing a variety of things. Now the question is, if he comes back to school, can he be the main guy? Can he slot into that role? And I'm still going back and forth when Moses gets to school, or Moses being on campus or whatever, is there going to, not bickering, but is there going to be a debate who's the main guy in that offense? Because I think Moses has shown that he could potentially be that. Now, he's an incoming freshman. Isaiah's going to get more of the looks and stuff initially, but we'll see what ends up happening with that dynamic and Eric Musselman, because I think Mus is going to want, maybe not to the extent of Mason this past season, but he's going to want someone that leads that offense in a variety of different ways. I think he's probably going to lean towards Isaiah at first, but look for Moses, and this is, again, if Isaiah comes back, look for Moses to make a push initially when it comes to that number one guy conversation.
Yeah, but Isaiah Joe's the guy we know. We know what he can do. Moses Moody's the guy we think we know what he can do. We don't know yet about Moses Moody because we hadn't seen it at the college level. We know what Isaiah Joe's capable of in the SEC. We know the difference in the impact the team felt when he was out with the knee injury. So we know about Isaiah Joe. We think Moses Moody can be that kind of player. We just don't know yet.
Craig in Greenwood asked a good question asking about Isaiah's timeline. He says, don't y'all think Isaiah waiting until August puts Mus in a bind from a roster perspective? Craig, I mentioned that before with Isaiah. And again, here's my thing on this. Isaiah might have already decided, you mentioned this earlier, secretly, like this could be a conversation him, Derek, his mom, and Mus have already had. It's like, hey, this is what we're going to do, blah, blah, blah. We're either going to go to school or come back. And so, and again, maybe he hasn't. Maybe they haven't had that conversation with Mus. But I wonder, like you, Craig, has Eric Musselman and this staff missed on a certain grad transfer or a certain transfer because Isaiah is still making the decision? Now, I've made the point several times, and I'll make it again. You would rather have Isaiah Joe on your roster in the 2020-21 season than any grad transfer, any transfer on the market. So for Mus and his staff, I think you take the chance of, hey, we could still get this guy back rather than not trying to get another guy. You still take the opportunity, whatever percentage it may be, that Isaiah might come back for another season. But that's a good point by Craig there.
Yeah, and I think when you look at the way Musselman wants to set up his roster, the playing time for players and transfer redshirt years, from that perspective, if he went kind of, as some are feeling, not unexpectedly, but last minute, doesn't that help Mus a little more, you know, craft the roster and the playing time the way he wants? It puts him in a bind because one of his best players are out there, but who are you going to go get in the transfer portal that's anywhere near Isaiah Joe's talent?
Especially at this point.
Particularly at this point.
So yeah. It's not existent. So, that's a rhetorical question.
Right. So what it probably does is it opens up 40 minutes a game that somebody else is going to get that was probably going to be sitting on the bench. And it allows one of these freshman players that, you know, me and you have went back and forth on whether one of those or two of those end up redshirting. It makes that conversation, that balance, a little easier for Musselman and his staff to figure out.
It's going to be interesting how this roster is constructed this year, how the minutes are played out. He mentioned, Tommy asked him, hit the question, and he said, not everyone's going to play. He told us straight up, he told all our Morning Rush listeners, not everyone is going to play, which has been a different mindset and a different philosophy than he's employed in years past. GT in Fort Smith texts in, he says, and Joe would potentially be the marquee player on a better team. Yep. GT, that's a good point. I think everyone listening right now, barring some terrible thing that could happen in the future, think this basketball team is going to be better than this past season. I think you ask any college basketball expert, they will tell you the exact same thing. And you know as well as I do, when your team wins, that makes you look better, regardless of how much of an impact you had on that. Team success is sometimes just as important as individual success. I'll give you a great example. Emmanuel Quickley wins SEC Player of the Year, doesn't measure up to to Mason in statistics at all. But what does everyone point to? Best player on the best team. They don't say best player in the league. They say best player on the best team. And unfortunately for Mason, how the coaches voted in this conference, that hurt him in that award. Yeah. So you hope, I don't know if Isaiah, now he'll be definitely in consideration for SEC Player of the Year from both the AP, the coaches, other outlets and stuff. What you would hope as an Arkansas fan is if that conversation comes up with Isaiah competing against someone else in this league, that he is helped, not hurt, helped by the team success that you anticipate them having. We've had several different outlets already that have called Arkansas, this is going to be a top five team if Isaiah comes back. One 24/7 sports writer said, no, this is going to be a top three team in the SEC. So if Isaiah goes, Mason averaged, 22 points this past season, if I remember that correctly? If you get Isaiah in the 20 pluses and Arkansas is a top three team in the league, I think there might be riots in the street if Isaiah doesn't win SEC Player of the Year from the coaches, unless someone just blows the doors off this conference. That would be a conversation that you'll definitely inch towards this upcoming season, but the key, again, is team success.
So if Isaiah Joe opts to go forward with his professional aspirations and stay in the NBA draft, is this still a tournament team? Is this a team that, how confident are you now that Eric Musselman can figure out the equation to get them to the tournament?
We need to temper the expectations on this because I know everyone listening right now is excited about Fort Smith zone Jalen Williams, Jacksonville zone Devontae Davis, Bryant and Little Rock zone KK Robinson, and then also Moses Moody. But we just need to remember these are true freshmen entering a league that they have never, ever participated in. Now, if Isaiah is to return, if he decides, coach, I'm coming back for my junior season, the expectation should be NCAA tournament and probably middle tier. I don't know if Sweet 16 is too high at this point. We'll see how the season plays out. But we brought up several times on this show, right now you have 10 new players that have never participated in Arkansas basketball in a college game. You have guys that were there last year that redshirted. You have the four incoming freshmen. And then you have grad transfers that have played in college but haven't played for Mus and Arkansas. So the chemistry is going to be vital for this team to have success. You have to get to a point early on in the season. Now, Ethan, Desi, and Isaiah played AAU together. Isaiah played with Mason. I think there was 1 year of overlap, if I remember that correctly. KK played with Moses growing up. So there's connections on this team, Tommy. But it's not going to just like work as soon as they get to campus. They're going to have to figure out each other's tendencies, how each other's play. Oh, this guy's really good at finding me in this spot. This guy's really good at coming off pick and rolls. They're going to have to learn from each other. And that's why these practices leading up, which hopefully the coronavirus stops and we'll be able to worry about that, they are so important for the basketball team moving forward because they got to get cohesive. They got to get combined together.
I agree with all that, but don't you think there's just enough talent to be one of the four, five, six best programs in the SEC and at least get in the field? I'm not saying second weekend. I'm not saying Elite Eight. I'm talking about with Isaiah Joe, you're not confident to say that's a tournament team?
I said, but you said without.
No, I'm saying, can they make it without him? I'm also asking, are they a shoe-in in your mind? They are definitely a tournament team.
With Isaiah.
Without him, I don't know. I'm with you. I don't know that they can make the tournament. So,
which would leave some to believe that Deans aren't necessarily trending in the right direction, which that's a debate for another day. But no, I thought I was clear on that. Yeah, this is a tournament team with Isaiah.
Yeah, okay.
So just it's debatable without him. I think it's pretty clear. It's open ended.
Well, tournament. You spent time. That's what I was asking. You spent all your time talking about without him, and I was with him. Do you feel?
Yeah,
I just
100%.
I want to just make sure we're not.
That's trust me. That's something we don't have to disagree.
I think they're
on
a Sweet 16 team potentially. I mean, we need to see a whole lot more. But with him, I think this is a team that top three in the SEC.
Well, that's the thing. People see the pieces. They see that four top 100 kids. They see an Isaiah who could potentially be a first rounder. They see two of the top 20 grad transfers, maybe three of the top 25 grad transfers, and they say, oh, this is just going to work. Well, it's not as simple as people think it's going to be.
Find the right combination.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't just mesh and think it's going to work. That's why, again, now if it does, then yeah, exactly right. Probably top three team in the SEC, Sweet 16 potentially on the horizon. But we're again getting into the conversation of playing time, of what could happen in that locker room. I mean, these top 100 kids, KK, Moses, Devontae, and Jalen, they didn't come to school to redshirt, period. They came to school to play. They didn't, they probably.
Who's in charge ultimately of that decision?
They didn't come. They didn't probably expect three grad transfers to come in. And they're still up in the air on Isaiah. I mean, let's be honest. If you're recruiting these guys, Muss, Corey Williams, when Crutch was here, Mosier, I guarantee you grad transfers weren't brought into, up in the conversation that much. So,
based on Muss's history, shouldn't you kind of know that? I mean, the way he handled business at Nevada, it shouldn't be surprising to you if you're one of these four freshmen that there's new grad transfers and an overhaul of the roster.
Well, here's why you should be surprised, because the overhaul that you're talking about, Tommy, he literally said last season that how he constructed his roster is he had three or four guys that would sit out. So if you're an incoming player, you expect him to continue on that trend. I get your what you're saying, but you expect, I would think, as a true freshman, seeing what he's done in years past, seeing what he just said, not to say that this can't work his new thing, but you would expect him to follow the trend he just said this pat, right?
Right. So if four guys have to sit out and they have to be either in a transfer or redshirt year to do that.
But it's typically, he from what I've seen,
there's just not,
I'd have to go back.
The math don't work.
I know that's what I'm saying, but I'd have to go look back in the roster. But typically his guys, I don't think he's had many. Right, like he really hasn't recruited a lot of high school kids.
You need more transfer players and not grad transfer players.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So I would think that the players are a little, I don't know if weary or a little, but they should be worried about playing time.
I think a lot of this, from a philosophy standpoint, is what was Arkansas this past year? They were an undersized team that got beat up on the glass. Fair? And that's pretty, I mean, just look at the season stats and compare them to opponent rebounds, and that was a big problem for Arkansas. What are they going to be now? Just a totally transformed team with a lot of size that they didn't have a year ago. So clearly he went out to get some guys on the roster that can rebound and provide some height.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a light and flavorful beer for those easy drinking occasions.
The crowd's into it. They just threw him out of the game. They just threw him out of the game. He's gotten his second technical, and he's been thrown out of the ballgame.
Richard, good morning, man. You had a good conversation with Morrilton shooting guard in the 2022 class, Joseph Pinion. What'd you learn in your conversation with Joseph, Richard?
Well, you know, June 15th was the first day that college coaches could reach out to prospects in the 2022 class, and obviously, a bunch of schools reached out to him, and he's added some offers. But I asked him about which schools were, you know, staying in contact with him the most, and he said Arkansas and Ole Miss. It didn't surprise me about Arkansas, and they're just making him a priority like the other guys in the class. And, you know, they're going to recruit you relentlessly, and you know, I think he's starting to see that in a very short period of time.
Richard, how are, just in your conversations with him and you kind of monitoring him on social media, how high do you think he is on Arkansas right now?
I think he's pretty high on Arkansas. He's an Arkansas kid. I think he's kind of grown up, rooting for the program. And I think at the end of the day, he'll probably be a Razorback, but can't guarantee that. He visited back in November and had a good time, and seems like he connected with the coaching staff pretty well, and I think his parents like Arkansas too. But if I had to wager right now, I would wager on Arkansas.
Richard, I thought you had a really interesting story, kind of dug into the football recruiting classes in the first year of the head coaches going back to Petrino. I thought it was a really interesting read when you kind of compared what's going on. What did you find as you went through the process of putting this article together, talking to Tom Lemming about how these first-year classes compared with the most recent head coaches?
Well, I think, for the most part, I don't think anybody would look at Bobby Petrino as being a great recruiter. He wasn't. It wasn't something he really loved doing. But if you look back at his first two classes, they were pretty impressive. And now he did inherit the best situation of all the coaches that I talked about in the story. Obviously Houston Nutt resigned and left the program, even though they struggled the first year. You know, he did have some players. I think the biggest reason for his struggle was the style of play and everything. But then you go to Coach Bielema, and he had some good classes in the first two, and probably the first class is maybe one of the most impressive ones. And then Chad Morris, recruiting wasn't a problem with him. It was on the field. Mm-hmm. And then with what Coach Pittman did this last class, that was probably maybe if you consider all things equal, and he and Morris having to go through the early signing period, and being able to throw a class together, he probably had the most impressive first class of the four coaches of Petrino, Bielema, Morris, and himself. So I think that bodes well for the future. And when you're recruiting off a 4-8, 2-10, 2-10 season, there's not a lot to sell other than yourself and a vision of what the program will be in a few years.
So watching this 12 or so years of history here, maybe a little bit longer than that, going back to the start of Petrino, all of them had great recruiting classes in class one and two, and then it fell off and waned. Other than winning games, which obviously is a key to improving recruiting, what's the next big deal? Is it staff stability? What do you think is the key for Sam Pittman to have as good of or better classes his third, fourth, fifth year potentially down the road than he does in year one and two?
I think stability definitely helps because, you know, they're already recruiting guys in the freshman class and sophomore class. And when you have a coach that's able to have a relationship with a kid for 2, 3, 4 years before signing day of his senior year, that definitely helps. And it's just continue to do what he's doing. I think he and Coach Morris had the similar type philosophy. You recruit him extremely hard to make it so hard that difficult to for them to say no, and make sure you involve the family. I think most staffs do, but you get to know the mom, you get to know the dad, you get to know the people that are important in that kid's life. And I think Coach Pittman obviously has that knowledge of over the years of recruiting and knows what works and what doesn't. And I think they're going to continue to be a staff of assistants, and with him, a staff that recruits extremely hard, stays in contact with the kids, and there's never ever a time when the kid thinks, "Am I wanted or not?" And with nowadays with prospects nowadays, they have to feel wanted. I think all people do, but I think this generation more so than any other generation.
Talking Arkansas football and recruiting with Richard Davenport here on the Morning Rush. Richard, on that note, he's learned from Kirby Smart, who's one of the best and highly regarded recruiting head coaches in the country. He's talked about it many times. You always got to be on. You always got to be recruiting. How much do you think his time at Georgia is going to help him recruiting at Arkansas?
Well, no doubt. He's mentioned that, talking about when he left Arkansas, he thought he was a pretty good recruiter, and then he went to Georgia, and under Kirby Smart, it was recruiting under steroids. Kirby obviously learned a lot from Saban. And when Saban got into the league, it seemed like recruiting just went to a different level. And, again, it goes back to just being relentless and recruiting kids and staying in touch with them and doing all the right things and making sure that they feel like that they're wanted. And I think that, you know, he was able to see for a few years how Kirby operated. And he's got some support staff members that came from Georgia with him. So that philosophy is definitely ingrained in him. From Kirby, so that's I think that is you're seeing a lot of what Arkansas is doing it, what Alabama and Georgia is doing.
Richard, one of the guys that's really highly regarded on that staff, not from Georgia, but it's Justin Steph, and he brought in 4 four-star wide receivers this past season. I know that they're on Ketron Jackson at Texas and a couple other guys right now. Just in kind of like the SEC and the confines of the Southeastern Conference, where does Justin Steph rank as a recruiter, especially at his position, coach, in the SEC?
I would tend to think the upper tier, just because what he did at Arkansas in the first couple of years, he was doing it with not much to sell other than what I said earlier, vision and obviously he being able to build relationships and trust with the kids. Mm-hmm. I think he would definitely be upper tier.
Talking with Richard Davenport here on the Morning Rush. Richard, like, when you look at some of the other, like Justin Sepp has been highly regarded, like we're just talking about, and you mentioned like bringing numbers of guys. I know Scott Fountain, the new special teams coordinator, some other guys that he's brought over from Georgia. Who do you think is going to make some noise in this upcoming recruiting class as far as that goes?
That's a good question. It's early. It's kind of early in the process, but you definitely, when you talk to kids that about certain members of the staff, Sam Carter is definitely one of them that you hear a lot of good things about. Barry Odom, and I'm going to sound like I'm saying every member of the staff, but when you constantly hear the same thing about a coach through the years of doing this, you realize who's really really enjoys the process and who's really a natural at recruiting. And I think he is definitely one of them. Ryan Rhodes is pretty good. Talking to some of the kids and some of the parents that I talked to, Kendall Briles obviously is well respected. I think Brad Davis is going to be an excellent recruiter and has already shown that. And Jimmy Smith, especially, we talked about him very early when he was hired on. His reputation in the state of Georgia is impeccable. Anybody you talk to in the state of Georgia, they're going to rave about him. And the kids also, when you talk about him, just says that he knows how to relate to them. And he gains that trust. And that's the number one thing when you're recruiting. If you're a coach and any of these coaches that I just talked about, John Cooper, throw him in there. I'm excited to see what this staff can do 2 to 3 years from now. But it's all about trust and gaining that trust and knowing that what that coach says is the truth.
I found one of the Tom Lemon quotes in your article kind of interesting from the standpoint of the level or the time commitment to recruiting in the SEC versus the Big Ten, and maybe Bielema and his staff never fully grasped that. We've seen what appears to be, at least from a social media and outward perspective, in basketball, Musselman's taken the focus and the time commitment to recruiting to a higher level than what Anderson had it. I think Sam Pittman's going to get that too. We referenced earlier his time with Kirby Smart and that time with Alabama that traces back to there. I think it's pretty clear, Richard, and I'd like your thoughts on this, that Sam Pittman and his staff understand the time commitment versus what Bielema and his staff are putting into recruiting, and it continues to ratchet up every year in the SEC.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you have SEC experience, I think that definitely helps because you know it's a dog-eat-dog world, and it's the SEC is the most relentless, and it can be the most negative recruiting conference in the country. I mean, I think Coach Muss has even hit on that a little bit, talking about how it's a different conference when it comes to recruiting, and I think that you're not going to have anybody outwork Coach Pittman and this staff, and Coach Muss too. And I think that's why I think that they'll be successful, because at Arkansas, you must work relentlessly because you don't have the in-state talent base that most of the other schools have. So most of your 2/3 of your class pretty much is coming from out of state. So you got to be on the phone and you got to be on Twitter at all times, because those kids, they're they're being told how great the University of Georgia is, Florida is, Alabama, University of Texas. They're very seldom ever hearing the word about any word about Arkansas. So you got to be able to sell them on that and get all those in-state schools where they live out of their mind and get Arkansas focused on them. So, and I will say one thing about Brett Bielema. He was the first coach to bring in graphics. And I think that, you know, that he did have that, philosophy and he brought that to Arkansas, and he was the first one to implement graphics in recruiting.
You should talk about these recruiting battles. It's part of what fuels these rivalries, and I don't think we quite get it here in Arkansas because we don't have a conference foe in our state, but, I mean, you see it. Alabama and Auburn compete over kid in recruiting just as hard as they do on the field in the Iron Bowl, and this goes on in the state of Mississippi and other places around the league. I think maybe that would help fuel this rivalry that's being crammed down our throats with Missouri. If Arkansas and Missouri both battle for kids, and I guess the only one you've really seen a great battle was for Doriel Green Beckham. But these battles in recruiting, I think, are paid attention a lot more to in these other places where it's just as entertaining to fans in the offseason watching the recruiting battles as it is the games on the field.
Yeah, if you don't have an in-state rival like in Alabama and Auburn, or even Georgia Tech, Florida State, Texas A&M, I think sometimes Arkansas fans don't understand the intensity of hate that those schools have for one another, and that definitely bleeds over to recruiting.
Richard Davenport of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette joins us every Thursday for a Recruiting Thursday. Richard, appreciate the time this morning, man. Have a great weekend, as always. We'll talk to you next Thursday.
All right, buddy. We'll see you guys.
The toughest questions.
What is going on?
The easiest answers.
Trivia!
Pick your category.
Light on medical knowledge, heavy on Broadway trivia.
Ty or Tommy.
Fight!
It's time for Trivia Thursday.
All right, Trivia Thursday. Last week it was Entourage Trivia. This week Tommy is elected to go with Garth Brooks Trivia.
Yeah, this is kind of just by accident. It really wasn't what I was thinking about earlier in the week, but I found myself in there's a documentary. It's a two-part series, about an hour and a half long each. Two episodes. I watched both of them last night on Netflix. My wife is not a country music fan. She put it on. She goes, "Here, I think you'd probably like this." So she watched both of them with me. If you're a Garth fan, I'm a fan. He's not like my all-time favorite, but it was pretty entertaining.
Let me tell you.
I thought, why not lean on the knowledge of 3 hours
you just watch,
of watching his watch?
All right, real quick story before we get into it. So, there's outdoor concerts up at the U of A sometimes, and one of the guys that came up was Chase Rice, who is a graduate of North Carolina, and he started talking trash about the North Carolina and Arkansas game back in the day. So my brother was unkind to him when he was up on stage. Even though he loves Chase Rice, he was unkind to him. So Chase brought him up on stage and had him sing the Garth Brooks song. I'm Friends in Low Places. Yeah. And my brother didn't know the words. So it was really entertaining and stuff to watch. But that's probably the only Garth Brooks songs I know is Friends in Low Places. So this could be a massacre as if it wasn't
the contest. You set me up with Entourage last week, so I figured this is tit for tat.
But you made it a contest last week, though. You made the comeback. You just ran a couple shorts.
Yeah. I just ran out of time. That's all it was.
So other than Friends in Low Places, do you know any other Garth Brooks songs?
Probably not. So this is going to be...
I feel like you'll know a few.
Yeah. I mean, he's an icon, right? I mean,
he's an icon.
I mean, he's on that same level with Michael Jackson. I mean,
George Strait. Like, if you're looking just country.
I'm just talking about artists in general.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you just look at record sales, concert sales, tours. I mean, dude's made hundreds of millions.
So a bunch of this trivial just kind of encompass the life of him. And then also, if we have some time, I got some name. I'll do the lyric, and then you tell me the song. So,
yeah, I'm
such a good one.
I'm just going to
get
different background music. So,
what's your favorite Garth Brooks song before we get started?
That's a good question. This one right here is pretty good.
That's good.
Tomorrow night.
I would
probably the dance is his best one ever.
The dance. I would go that one. Friends in Low Places or Unanswered Prayers.
Yeah.
But that's me. Okay. So we'll get this thing started. Let's see here. What is Garth Brooks' band of studio musicians called? Are they the G-Men, the Drifting Cowboys, Ace in the Hole Band, or the Tennessee Three?
The G-Men.
Very good. That is correct.
All right. Only one I'll get.
Now, you'll do good. How did Garth Brooks meet his first wife? In a traffic accident, delivering a pizza, throwing her out of a bar, or performing at the Renaissance Fair?
He's at the bar.
Throwing her at the bar.
So he like, who's Swayze play in Roadhouse? What's his character's name?
It's Dirty Dancing, I can tell you that, but I don't know Roadhouse. So
you guys hadn't seen Roadhouse?
I've seen it.
I just can't call it off.
It's been a minute since I've seen Roadhouse.
Okay, well,
you're the one asking the question that you don't know the answer to.
You guys looked at me like I was an alien when I asked you about Roadhouse.
Well, you do have that third ear growing out of your neck. So.
Yeah. What did Garth Brooks pass out at the front row of fans at the end of his 1991 concert? Autographed Stetsons, which is a guitar, his ex's phone number, pieces of his guitar, or popcorn? These are the three most obscure questions I'll ask this whole trivia. These are obscure.
Keep them very obscure. Make it a competition a little better.
Stetsons.
Incorrect.
I hope it's his ex's phone number.
I really wish it was. It was actually pieces of his guitar. Okay. He smashed his guitar and then passed it out to the rest of his fans.
That was featured last night on that docuseries.
Yep. All right. In the song The Dance, Brooks sings that our lives are better left to fate.
I'll give you no.
You want to guess? Or do you want me to give you some choices?
Choices. I mean, if you know it, don't listen.
Do you know it?
I'm trying to sing it in my head. If y'all be quiet.
No.
I was putting this whole thing together. I was singing the whole morning.
Yeah.
In the song "The Dance," Brooks sings that our lives are better left to fate, chance, God, or destiny.
It's chance.
It's chance. Very good. And I really appreciate if all of you are singing out there as I'm doing these right now. So, fun fact: actually, Garth Brooks signed with 3 Major League Baseball teams during spring training. Who did he sign with first?
Ooh.
Who did he sign with first? The Kansas City Royals, San Diego Padres, or the New York Mets? He signed with all 3 of them, but who did he sign with first?
The Mets.
Incorrect.
Padres.
Padres is correct.
I didn't know that one.
He signed with them in 1999, invited them to spring training. Then he did the same thing with the Mets the next year, and then the Kansas City Royals in 2004. Even more of a reason to like Garth Brooks. Let's see here. Try to not do so much obscure ones. Who originally recorded Garth Brooks' number one, or excuse me, who originally recorded Garth Brooks' 1991 hit, The Thunder Rolls? Who originally recorded it? Kenny Rogers, Tanya Tucker, Reba McEntire, or Dwight Yoakam? Do you know any of those 4 names I just said?
I know Reba.
Okay.
That's your guess?
It's not my guess. I just know who it is. Mm. I mean, I'm going to assume who are the 2 men? Dwight Yoakam. Who's the other guy?
Kenny Rogers. Incorrect.
Dwight Yoakam.
Incorrect. It was actually Tanya Tucker.
Tanya Tucker. All right.
More you know.
I didn't know someone had recorded it prior to Garth.
All right. What time is at the beginning of The Thunder Rolls? What time is it at the beginning of The Thunder Rolls?
Ooh, let me sing this in my head real quick. 3 o'clock in the morning.
No.
Give me the answers.
1:30 p.m., 3:30 p.m., 1:30 a.m., or 3:30 a.m.?
3:30 a.m.
Very good.
3:30 in the morning. Not a soul in sight. City's looking like a ghost town. I don't want to ruin another on a moonlit summer night.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hey, Ty, you're in the lead 3-2 right now,
all
buddy.
All right.
On Garth Brooks Street. What is Garth Brooks' real first name?
Ooh.
Tobias? Tyrell? Troil or Torin?
Tobias.
Incorrect.
What were the last two?
Last two, Troil and Torin.
Troil.
Troil is correct.
Wow. From downtown.
In which song does Brooks sing took a match to everything she ever wrote? In which song does Brooks sing took a match to everything she ever wrote. Standing outside the fire? What's she doing now? Learning to live again or more than a memory?
That is an obscure lyric, I think, there, isn't it?
That's what I thought.
So why'd you ask it?
Well, I'm trying to help you out.
I can't even place that one.
No,
say
no,
it's fine.
Standing outside the fire, what's she doing now? Learning to live again or more than a memory?
More than a memory.
Ty's correct.
Good guess.
That was a really good
guess. I'd have been guessing.
Let's see here.
I'm getting killed.
Crushed. This one shouldn't be obscure. This one should be, I would think it'd be easy. What was the first song to ever debut at number one on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart? Friends in Low Places, The Dance, More Than a Memory, or The Thunder Rolls?
I saw this last night.
Friends in Low Places, The Dance, More Than a Memory, or The Thunder Rolls?
You don't want to guess first.
I'll go first. Friends in Low Places.
That is incorrect.
The Dance.
Incorrect. It is actually More Than a Memory. We're going to ask Ty this one first because you'll know this one, obviously. So if you'll get a free point if you don't get it. Ty, what country singer is Garth Brooks married to? Trisha Yearwood, Carrie Underwood, Faith Hill, or Shania Twain?
Faith Hill.
Trisha Yearwood.
Trisha Yearwood is correct.
Who's Faith Hill married to?
Tim McGraw.
Yeah.
Okay.
In Friends in Low Places, Brooks sings that he isn't big on... I ain't big on big
social
saints.
Social Graces.
Social Graces is
social
correct.
Social Graces, yeah. Why is it easy to sing along when you have the music?
Right.
You don't have the music.
In which song does a man run into his high school sweetheart at a football game in their hometown?
Unanswered Prayers.
That is correct. We are tied at 5. Last question. In what year was Garth Brooks inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame?
2012.
That is correct. Tommy is the big winner.
Eke that one out.
You did better.
It's kind of like me with Entourage. Like, I did better than I thought I would.
I got to work on my those questions for me.
Yeah, some of those were a little off in the weeds.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Bud Light Seltzer, 5% ABV and only 100 calories. We'd put it up against any other seltzer out there.